Welcome to Periodical Radio, the program about magazines and journals. I'm your host, Steve Black, librarian at the College of St. Rose in Albany, New York, and author of the book Serials and Libraries, Issues and Practices. Our periodical for this installment of Periodical Radio is the American Journal of Bioethics, a scholarly journal that publishes serious discussion of the social implications of biomedicine. Quoting from bioethics.net, the companion website to the journal, "Every issue of the American Journal of Bioethics contains peer-reviewed target articles that zero in on tough questions, answered by open commentary articles from scholars across disciplines and cultures." My guest is Dr. Glenn McGee, Editor-in-Chief of the American Journal of Bioethics. An internationally recognized expert on bioethics, Dr. McGee holds the John A. Balint Endowed Chair in Medical Ethics at the Albany Medical College in Albany, New York. Dr. McGee has published several books and numerous articles, serves on several boards of directors and ethics advisory boards, and has received awards for his scholarship, teaching, and service. I am honored to have Dr. McGee as my guest. Well, Dr. McGee, welcome to Periodical Radio.
Thank you.
The American Journal of Bioethics began publication relatively recently in 2001. What need does the journal fill?
It's true. It is relatively recent. Although I'm 40, so I like thinking of this as a quarter of my life or something like that. Now, we're in volume 10. So, for all intents and purposes, we've been working the equivalent of 10 years, and it feels like much more than that. We came into existence a long time ago, because Massachusetts Institute of Technology's press company, somewhat independent of MIT, contacted me through an American philosopher that I had trained with years and years ago. They said, you know, hey, we do all this mind stuff and that sort of thing. Why aren't we doing bioethics? And I said, that's an interesting question. I did a little PowerPoint for them and showed them what was going on in the world of bioethics. And I said three things. First, books in bioethics, which at the time were still a big deal. People read books back then. Even medical people did. And I said, books in bioethics are targeted at a tiny audience at a time when Dolly the sheep has been born. That's stupid. Why aren't scholars writing to a more general audience? In part, that's got to have to do with the kind of editing that people do. So the dissemination of really thoughtful scholarship has got to be rethought. And second, I said, I think it's interesting and odd that with the number of journals in the field, and a field that's only 30 years old, that most people will say that a field like communication or sociology makes the turn inward. Nursing is the best example of this. Very quickly, they begin writing to each other so that they can legitimate their PhD program, so that everybody speaks a common language, etc. For 30 years now, bioethics journals have been written by people who work in this field, for people who work in this field. And, you know, in physics, that's easy to explain. In bioethics, people have claimed for 30 years that they were writing to a general audience. That is, that if Senator Kennedy were interested in the future of medicine, that he'd pick up a copy of the Hastings Center Report or the Cambridge Quarterly in Bioethics, to just name a couple of the journals that really are standouts in the field. And they'd read them and they'd, you know, do something. But the truth is that that never happened. And when we initially made our proposal, we said this: when people in the world of bioethics are rising today, and this is back in 1997 when we had our first conversations, today they go before deans and promotions committees, and they say to those people, here's my work. And the journals that were published at the time look like newsletters, still do mostly. They don't look like medical journals. They don't look like science journals. The review process is 2 years long, much more akin to the philosophy or classics journal that many of us are associated with. So assistant professors were literally being denied tenure, not on rate of publication, but on a combination of the fact that they're weird, you know, I mean, they don't get NIH grants, et cetera, and that their journals are unheard of. And so my claim was, as important as it is to reach the general audience, it's important to reach a scientific and medical audience. And I said, I think that's possible. So I said, I don't necessarily want to do it, but a way that we could try to do that is to build a kind of a system that would allow physicians, scientists, lawyers, and others to participate in not just peer-reviewed, you know, article submission, but also in discussions of those articles, and that the journals built around, and we're certainly not the first journal to do this, but journals that are built around that are going to turn out, I said, and I think I was pretty prescient in this regard, are going to turn out to be the journals that are most important. So, I mean, if you look at the Thomson ISI impact factor ratings today, among the journals that nobody would ever have guessed are most influential or most cited are journals like Nature Reviews Genetics. Nobody would ever have said, yeah, I want my faculty to publish in a reviews journal. And yet the fact that our journal really does have a kind of comprehensive, multidisciplinary approach with people talking to each other, and that it looks like a medical journal and has a title that invokes the notion that we are being responsible to scientists and doctors, that was important. I don't know why it's been as successful as it's been. I'd like to think that it's because it's so cited. We are, and where we're cited. Part of it probably has to do, though, with the fact that we have had just extraordinary luck with getting people who don't like to write for anybody but New England Journal, excuse me, to write for AJOP and to give us some of their best stuff. And, you know, with a jump start like that, you can really move ahead quite quickly.
Dr. McGee, given your expertise in ethics, I'd like to focus much of our interview on ethical issues surrounding journal publishing.
Sure.
To begin, could you sketch for our listeners some of the important ethical issues surrounding scientific publishing?
Well, I wrote a piece in Science's online subsection called Science Next Wave called Does It Take a Village to Write an Article? From the time that I started teaching, I spent my first 10 years of my career at University of Pennsylvania. And as anybody in the world of medicine knows, there's a mandatory course for biomedical scientists in ethics. I call it the pizza and blackberry course. It takes about 4 hours usually. The students read the newspaper, and they're told a kind of mantra, do not steal data, do not pretend that you're an author, or let anyone else pretend that they're an author with your own knowledge. Do not in any way fabricate data, so, you know, don't be Wang Wu-suk and say you've cloned something, or paint mice, as Summerlin famously did. But I wrote a piece before the authorship piece, actually, in the Chronicle of Higher Education, in which I said, this is ridiculous. I mean, you know, we've got articles by National Institutes of Health and other places called On Being a Scientist that are designed to fix that. But my quote that gets requoted all the time is, if someone comes to your ethics program out of their basic science lab and they already believe that it would be okay to paint a mouse black, you're not going to convince them otherwise in 4 hours with pizza. And I think that fact has led to a broader conversation. With every new small ethics scandal comes increased attention to a broader problem that crosses medical journals. So when you have the editors in chief of New England Journal and JAMA both resign, when you have or are fired, right? When you have one of them, Catherine DeAngelis, become an ethicist and go on a mission to crunch conflict of interest in journal publishing, then it's time to focus on those issues. The one that I focused on first, as I said, was authorship. I think it's become clear that in the world of medical publishing, it is almost impossible to know who's an author. I mean, we just don't know, right? I mean, it's easy to know. I was trained as a philosopher. Very few articles in philosophy were co-authored until roughly 1985. And after that, the co-authorship that exists for some very specific purpose, where the people that are participating, they would never think in general, of a junior or senior partnership. And if they do, they would label it, and you know, they'd write another paragraph about how much of a role one person played versus another. In a typical science piece by a big lab, the guy who gets the person who gets the money, woman, man, who raises the money that makes the lab go will be what's called senior author or last author. Some people know what that means. So, for example, when I first arrived at Albany Medical College, I talked about how my plan was, as a person who was moving into a department chair position for the first time, to move from first author, where I'd been on the first 100 publications I'd had or so, to last author, because that's a good place to be, anchoring things, helping to set the compass, but not playing the primary role in writing the article. And he said to me, well, why would it be better to be last? Right. In some worlds, that's not recognized. They just don't get it. Right. In the world of biomedical science, by contrast, National Institutes of Health, for example, if you don't have 5 or 10 publications as last author, then that means you're not senior. And by the same token, first author is how you build your career. Second author can be just as important. Everybody else doesn't count. And yet maybe they do. I was just on a paper in Circulation about ethical issues in cardiac care and where genetic testing is going in medicine. I was the ethicist to the group, and I was an important part of the group. I think I'm 17th author out of 20-something. I don't even know what that means, right? I mean, I reviewed a couple of paragraphs and worked on it. The questions that have been asked, and then I asked in Does It Take a Village, are do you have to write, number one, as Mildred Cho asserted in a pretty prominent article in Science, authors write, right? Do you have to contribute if you didn't write in a special way? And what would that mean, right? I mean, in other words, does raising funding for a lab independent of anything else count? And, you know, if you begin to kind of run through the list of things that count about authorship, a lot of them have less to do with who gets credit than with who gets blamed. So in the Korean stem cell scandal, when the University of Pittsburgh scientist, who had essentially facilitated the publication of the most important paper, which was also the most fraudulent paper, about the purported cloning of human embryos, he wrote the editor of Science and said, I want to be pulled off this paper. He was senior author. And so, I was involved in conversations with them. Ultimately, I was second author on a 3-author paper in Science called Ethical Lessons of the Korean Stem Cell Scandal, in which we said, among other things, what Science said, which is you can't pull a senior author, right? I mean, you're responsible for the paper. Scandals also have a lot to do with this. And that's important because if you're a student, or a junior faculty member, today publication is how you get grants in if you're working in that world. And even if you're not, increasingly publication is through teams is incredibly important. And I can tell you from my own experience as an author that it is incredibly difficult to know where you stand with other authors, that the different disciplines have such incredibly different standards for what it means to have collaborated or for everyone to agree. So, for example, in biomedical sciences, everybody on the team might sign on to a paper, but author number 4 might disagree completely with its conclusions. And that would not be viewed as inappropriate or wrong, even though many of the new sign-off sheets for these journals have a paragraph in them that say something like, you know, I hereby agree that I am a part of this and agree with what the paper says. Not its conclusions necessary, but, you know, that this is not stuff I disagree with. Right? It'd still not be viewed as odd at all for 1, 2, 3, 4 of those people to just agree with the work that they did on the paper. In a law review article that I myself recently participated in, it was viewed as, and this is a standard issue for a law review, where no one ever writes a multiple author paper, it was viewed as unthinkable that a couple of the authors on the paper disagreed with the conclusions of the paper, and ultimately they pulled off. And so here I am, a journal editor, and I myself had found myself in what I think of as the swamp of authorship today. We ourselves had to pull one of the papers about the Korean scandal because we ultimately said, the group that had written, I mean, when we withdrew it and in our retraction article in the American Journal of Bioethics, we said the group that had promised that there was an ethics code that was followed in Korea. This was one of the most important papers we'd published. It was hugely prestigious, quoted in AP stories, appeared in every newspaper in the English-speaking world that carries the AP. We had to retract this paper because we could not vouch for the fact that those people had actually any clue what had or hadn't gone on in the laboratory. And, you know, thinking about that led us to have to write a paper about what we call gee whiz or I was there papers, a category that didn't even exist a year ago. And that category means, you know, the kind of quick bang it out 600-word article for Nature or AJOB or whatever, where you say, we don't really know yet, but this is what we think we saw, right? Go ahead.
Glenn, in Volume 2 of AJOB, you and Kelly Carroll, the managing editor, co-authored a conflict of interest policy for the journal.
Yes.
Could you describe what the policy is and why it was necessary?
Well, we crafted the policy because no one else in bioethics had one. And we thought it was important, as we said, that there be policies about this because we ourselves had encountered situations in which the non-disclosure of a conflict of interest in submissions had then surfaced, ranging from peer reviewers saying, by the way, I work with this person, and or authors calling furious and saying, you know, why didn't you find out that this person is really my department chair, even though the name of the department differed? And more importantly, conflicts of interest in bioethics became a big deal after scandals about so-called ethics advisory boards. And I'll admit that I started this problem. I resigned quite publicly from Advanced Cell Technology, the largest stem cell corporation in the world. I resigned as chair of their ethics advisory board after the ethics advisory board was not told that the company was experimenting with making clones of zoo animals. And essentially I said in my resignation letter, which was printed in the Washington Post, or in large part, and then on the front page of the New York Times, in large part, I said this is, you know, the danger here is that ethics advisory boards in the world of stem cells, pardon me, we as ethicists are beginning to play a role where we're rubber stamps, and that's dangerous. Another bioethicist at University of Minnesota said it more, in a more clever way. He said, bioethicists have gone from being guard dogs to being lap dogs. And I think he was right in saying that that's a real risk. That pointed to something that right-wingers, as bioethics has become more and more political, and more of those who are Republican have said bioethics is mostly peopled by liberals, right? Well, a number of those, and for example, the White House Domestic Policy Council actually started to say things like, you know, you guys are owned, you're bought and sold. And at the same time, and this is a really critical fact about bioethics scholarship, in the old days, when I was doing my postdoc, for example, there was what my boss, Art Kaplan, used to call the Full Employment Act. If you wanted to study bioethics, there was so much money, you had to beat it away because of the Human Genome Project, which gave 5% to ethics. In the world of stem cells, well, there's no money, right? All the money is from venture capital, except in California. And so if you wanted to study ethical issues in human embryonic stem cell research, you basically had one and only one choice, and that was to go work with one of the groups. Because the stuff's all under patent. It's all totally secret. The biggest company, Advanced Cell, is not traded publicly, or wasn't until very, very recently, if they are now. So there was this problem with conflict of interest that we felt like we had to deal with. So we created a policy, and we decided as long as we were going to be first, we would try to go beyond the existing policies. We'd adhere to the other ones, but we'd go beyond, and we went beyond in the following way. We said, we will disclose everything about what we earn. So, you know, I'm invited to give talks, and particularly was then during the Dolly era, for drug companies, right? So I'll disclose every dollar that I get from doing anything for anybody, and we'll essentially release our tax returns. My co-editors, those who work with me on the editorial group, agreed to it. I won't say reluctantly because I don't really remember. But then, you know, we created this policy, and nobody cared. I have to say that policy was received with a resounding nothingness. Until finally, Carl Elliott, whom I mentioned earlier, wrote a piece, I believe in the Atlantic Monthly, but I wouldn't swear by it. It might have been New Republic, in which he hammered bioethicists. The piece he's written 5 or 6 times, same piece over and over again. And in this piece, he really focused on AJOB, and he said, look, I want this thing, and I've been asking them for this conflict of interest thing forever, and I'm not getting it. And it proved, if nothing else, that there's at least one guy out there who'd like to see a conflict of interest policy in bioethics not only be good, but lead the way.
I was particularly struck by the requirement that peer reviewers had to disclose the sources of research funding and any other relationships relevant to the article that they're reviewing.
Mm-hmm.
Has that requirement made it difficult to recruit reviewers?
No, not at all. The only thing that makes it hard to get peer reviewers is that nobody wants to be a peer reviewer.
So you don't think it's changed there?
No, I don't. I think that actually, first of all, there's almost no corporate money in bioethics. I mean, you know, so I say I give talks occasionally for pharmaceutical companies, and I'm happy to be able to do that when it happens. But the list of Carl Elliott's complaints about corporate money going into bioethics, you can really only name 2 or 3 bioethics programs out of the maybe 4,000 that exist that receive any corporate money of any consequence. The list of people who have received more than $100 from anybody, any group at all that has any investment in anything, probably less than 100, it's not a big problem. Conflict of interest for peer reviewers occurs that's the sort of policy we hoped would spread to avoid things like, I don't know, peer review of an article about Vioxx in New England Journal, right?
But it hasn't caught on in medical journals.
I don't think so, but when I talk, for example, to the people who were working with Catherine DeAngelis or to my peers in the various committees that I serve on, it wasn't that people weren't interested, it's that they really do fear that that won't work out. And we published probably our most controversial article ever. No, that's not true. We published a lot of really crazy controversial articles. But the one that was most controversial within our field was an article by James Coyne that was about, essentially, it was an argument that a particular psychiatrist working in Canada is bought and sold. And that article, which dealt with conflict of interest, created what I would describe as the biggest flap in the history of bioethics, because the argument that was made was that, and this is really why we started with this conflict of interest policy as a thing that we thought was unavoidable, as opposed to, you know, what I argued before, which is that we wanted to do it anyway. We had to do it quick, in my view, because we were watching as other journals were having problems when they published papers by non-bioethicists. So Hastings Center Report, fairly famously, published a paper by the psychiatrist whom I'm talking about, in which that psychiatrist said that antidepressants caused suicide, and it's a huge problem, and accused Lilly in particular of hiding data about that. And he said that in a bioethics journal. He subsequently said that in American Journal of Bioethics. And when James Coyne wrote his article, which is really, I mean, even though we published it, it's a broadside attack on us, the journal, American Journal of Bioethics. What he pointed out is that this story about how American Journal of Bioethics and Hastings Center published these pieces by a psychiatrist, that psychiatrist went on to testify in a number of cases about suicides by children, in which he cited as scientific data his publications in the ethics journals, literally. And Coyne's right. I mean, that in fact happened. So is it a conflict of interest? Yes. But it's bigger than that. It's that we're not equipped by peer review to do certain kinds of things. And everybody I know in the publication world remembers the debacle, I'm blanking on the name of the guy, who published the postmodern physics article.
Andrew Sokol?
The Sokol affair, right?
Yeah.
So the Sokol affair, right, it stands out. But ultimately, it was just a way in which people could argue about whether or not postmodern scholarship was real, whether or not it would be irresponsible to submit a fake article to a journal. In this case, for someone to publish purported scientific data in an ethics journal, and then it survives our peer review process, right? In our case, it was a peer commentary. That's a huge deal. I mean, these were testimony issues for, you know, life and death issues. And the biggest problem was that the argument that the Hastings Center report made was that as soon as the article that this psychiatrist published came out in the Hastings Center report, that Lilly, who had been a big sponsor of the Hastings Center, pulled its annual contribution to the Hastings Center. And the Hastings Center bragged and bragged and bragged for years about how they they weren't influenced by companies, even though they had tons of money from companies, and I believe still do, because, you know, look, they took that standing up, they got, you know, they lost the $30,000, and that was too bad, but that's just how it had to go. And
Glenn, can I? Mm-hmm. We have only 5 minutes left, or
maybe
a little bit less. So I wanted to ask you one last question that's a different topic. What's your take on open access publishing, where the costs of running a journal mm-hmm. are paid up front by an author pays modelers grants or some other method, and then they're made freely available to anyone with a web connection?
Unethical. I think it's unethical, and it's unethical in the guise of being ethical, which makes it worse. I think the idea, of course, of providing scholarship free of charge is one that the world of the Internet is more than prepared to provide. I think that the day is going to come in the not-too-distant future when the publishing world will be split into scholarly journals and not-so-scholarly journals, and scholarly journal editors who still own their journals will be able to say, look, this is just not right, et cetera. Already we push, for example, our company, and they agreed to give access to any library in developing world, et cetera, but to put the burden of peer review, et cetera, on a potential author, this is disproportionate. It's unfair taxation. I mean, essentially, it's the taxing of the poor, because it's assistant professors who are going to turn to those journals, and when those assistant professors do turn to the journals and fork over a huge amount of money, not only are they forking over that money for journals that don't have high impact factors, but the appearance in almost every discipline that those aren't real publications isn't something that those journals are disclosing. So I really do, honestly, I think that it's really insipid that, although I don't think anybody intended for it to be this way, but I think it's insipid that the argument that's being made is, hey, nope, you know, we're making things free, isn't that great, the libraries don't have to pay. Well, these universities that are funded by grants from Duke and Stanford and Vanderbilt and huge corporate grants and so on, who are cutting their library budgets, those are the people who actually aren't paying for the journal subscriptions. So saving money for them by charging their faculty seems a little bit strange.
So you would be against the little bit of legislation in a large bill that's kind of in the works right now the requirement would be that anybody who publishes something with NIH funding would then have to deposit their article on the web within a year.
Well, that's a different issue. I mean, I think there's absolutely no question that I think authors should have a choice, but that's a different issue. I mean, the issue as to whether or not people who work in government institutions, even under the Bayh-Dole Act, should be providing their information because it's federally funded for free is a very different question than whether or not open access journals should charge assistant professors $1,000 to submit an article. I think those are just completely different issues. If what it means is just that, as physicists do, they'll just stick that stuff up on the web, on an NIH website, well, who's to object? I think ultimately the biggest issue is going to be, so I'm a journal editor in bioethics, and if someone at the NIH has to put their stuff up on the NIH website, at the end of the day, What's going to happen to them when they have to leave the NIH and want to go get a real job working in bioethics at a university? What's going to happen to them, right? Because their journal articles have no impact factor whatsoever. I think that's going to hurt them, and I think we should be very careful about moving in that direction.
Dr. McGee, I could speak to you for much longer, but unfortunately our half hour is up.
Well, I appreciate very much your calling, and I think this is a fabulous, fabulous idea, and I'm happy to help you.
You have been very helpful. Thank you. To subscribe to the American Journal of Bioethics or to read Dr. McGee's blog, go online to bioethics.net. Thank you for listening to this installment of Periodical Radio. I'm your host, Steve Black.